Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, everybody, let's hang tight and look for landing radar.
Flight guidance.
No guidance.
We'll need that landing radar by 18,000 with this down track.
Roger.
On the pings.
Roger, copy guidance.
Okay,
we got data back.
Radar flight looks good.
Roger.
2,000 feet.
Roger. 2,000 foot del H. Your gunner goes based on the data he had prior to LOS. I see we got it back. Give you another few seconds.
We're yelling fine.
Okay, retro.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guide.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom. We're go to continue. PDI.
Coming to you live from the slopes of the ghost-filled Sierra Nevada gold country and in the paranormally active shadow of Mount Rainier, it's Ghost Rider Paranormal Radio with your hosts, John Almada and Kat Lang. Testing. Am I on the air? Let me try it again. Malfunction there. Okay, we gave that a second try. This is your host, John Almada, over at Ghost Rider Paranormal Radio. Had a little moment of panic there. Heard some odd fluctuations in the music at my end, and my board went dead, and I went, what in the heck is going on? But anyway, it seems to have stabilized, and I think it's probably one of those government conspiracies, because tonight we're going to be talking about UFOs and a little bit of background about some of the things that inspired our guest tonight, and his name is Richard Phillips, and he wrote a book that I'm almost all the way through called The Second Ship. And Richard was, I'm going to go ahead and read his bio here. He's actually called in a bit early, so I think I'll just shift the show around here. So he's waiting patiently out on the line here, and I see that we also... Yeah, good. Yeah, I see that, Brian. Thank you for letting me know that we can be heard. I appreciate that, my friend. Anyway, we have, again, Richard Phillips here, writer of The Second Ship. And he was born in Roswell, New Mexico in 1956. And Richard graduated from West Point in 1979, trained as an Army Ranger, and served for several years as an officer in the United States Army. In 1989, he graduated with a Master of Science degree in physics from the Naval Postgraduate School, completing his thesis work at Los Alamos National Laboratory. I've dealt with him a few times in my work. He then spent 3 years as a research associate at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory before completing his tour of duty as an Army officer. He now lives in Phoenix, Arizona with his lovely wife, Carol, and can be found visiting with fans and customers at Carol's Restaurant, the Arizona Bread Co. Cafe. So that's a little bit about our guest. And again, his novel, The Second Ship, if you go out to the show page, you'll see the Amazon.com link there for that. And there's some pretty good reviews for that out on the Amazon site. I was just checking that before the show. And so I'm going to go ahead and see if he's ready to pop on. And hello to our guests out there. Folks are filtering in on this special Saturday night show. So we're going to go ahead and see if Richard is out there.
Yes, I'm out here.
All right, Richard, welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure having you on. And I really have been enjoying your writing the last couple of days. I've been going through the book and decided to stop at, let me pull it up here. I left it right here. It's chapter 72. I've just got past the Roe Project Nanite Suspension Fluid. And I really liked what you did with the NSA.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, and we'll get into a little bit of it. But one of the aspects of, you know, the second ship in the Roe Agenda series, of which it's the first novel, is really has some underlying subtext. First of all, you know, I wanted to make it an entertaining novel. But there's some reasons why it's a novel. And since, you know, I've done a lot of classified work at the National Laboratories and still maintain an active clearance for some of the ongoing work I do for the military, you know, there's quite a few limitations on specifics of types of things that I can talk about. But what I wanted to do when I wrote The Second Ship and the Roe Agenda series was, you know, tell an entertaining story, but also mix in as much real science as I could get away with, and at the same time touch on some things that we can't quite do right now yet, you know, right now, but we're surprisingly close on. And there's a bunch of those things sprinkled in throughout the novels. And what I always find is entertaining is some of the things that people believe are maybe the most outlandish types of technologies in the second ship are actually some of the ones we are the very closest to nailing down. So anyway, I had a lot of fun doing that. And you know, one thing you mentioned is on my background is that I was born in Roswell. I grew up just kind of as a little side note. I grew up in that area, but I grew up in a little town. You know, Roswell's not big. It's a town of about 50,000 people. But I grew up in a town that makes it look big, a little town called Lincoln, about 60 miles away from there, and graduated from a high school named Capitan High School. And there were a total of only 12 seniors, counting me and my high school graduating class. So this wasn't a big place. And so you can imagine I had a fair amount of culture shock when I went off to New York in West Point. And in fact, when I came into New York City with a couple of my buddies on our way to West Point, I mean, I was so new to the city environment that, you know, I didn't even know things like, as we were going to the hotel and the taxi cab, the meter, I wasn't sure whether, now does that mean we're all going to pay that amount individually, or you know, so I was in for quite a culture shock getting out there, but I made it through, graduated in 79 like you mentioned, and then qualified as an Army Ranger, did several years of that. So a lot of these things between my work at the National Laboratories and my research background and my military background, I worked to blend those things together into The Second Ship.
Okay. And I noticed, I mean, it's unmistakable some of the Roswell-like references, but you took, again, like what you said, you took a lot of the newer technologies, like the quantum the quantum communication device, I can just say QT and mix that in. And I think you were referring to quantum entanglement. And I'm not a, no physicist myself, but I'm a computer scientist over in the defense industry in my own little area. But I saw that, and I was really, I thought that was really cool what you did with that, and the way they bugged the laboratory with that broken airplane. I just thought that was brilliant. And,
right. Well, it's, one of the things that that comes out in there, and you are talking about quantum entanglement, and for, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with that, but there's lots of things that are real science inside inside the series. And one of the purposes is to try to make people think a little bit. You know, one of the things that always gripes me is I think that way too many people take things at face value that we're told either by the scientific community or by the government in general. And they a lot of people tend to take these things as facts. You know, the science says that something is or is not possible, and they take that as a fact. Now, what we have out there in science in general is the same thing we've had. I mean, it's been this way throughout history, is a lot of very brilliant people working in these fields. And I'm not even talking about at the national laboratories right now. I'm talking more generally in the scientific community. But these are very bright people, and they get and they become experts on a particular subject, okay? And they become very heavily vested in the current state of thinking on that subject. So, for example, the what we have is a set of models, the way things work in physics. It's just our current theories are just a set of models. The models that we have that we think best describe what makes things work and how they work now. But those models are just models, and I guarantee you one thing, and it's always proven true, is 100 years from now, they're going to find our models laughable. But we don't tend to make those assumptions in the scientific community. Most scientists believe, actually, that we're pretty close to having things worked out. And what I tried to do in the second ship is throw out some things that are on the edge of current theory, but do it in a context where which allowed me to point out that some of our underlying assumptions are not necessarily correct at all, and in fact could be dead wrong. And for example, when you talk about quantum entanglement, what that is that's a that's where two particles at the tiniest level acquire this property known as quantum entanglement, which means they are bound together so that changes in one cause an immediate change in the other without any information passing between them. Now scientists believe that this can't really be used as a good communications mechanism or things like this, because current theory calls that there has to be kind of a carrier wave signal back and forth between these two so that you can sync up the states. But the thing about that is not necessarily correct. When you think about things that are publicly available to talk about that are not classified, you can imagine at the national laboratories, like at Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore, and there's many others, both in the United States and outside the United States, that a lot of these, this work that's so exciting out in the public, you can just imagine the type of things that are going on at these deep black programs. And let me say, there is some very, very exciting stuff going on.
Yeah, I grew up in the defense industry myself. I was born, as we've talked about before, in El Paso, and so was your daughter. You were talking about. And same hospital, as a matter of fact. But, I grew up with my dad working out at White Sands, and he did a bunch of work for the Army Chemical Corps. And that was an organization in the 50s that was doing chem-bio nuke type work. And he would disappear for long periods of time and then come back and not talk a lot. But he always said that through the years that these things were usually 20 to 30 years ahead of what we have at any one time. that you
can get. You know, it's really hard nowadays to put a number on that, but in general, that is very correct. I mean, things are accelerating. That's why I say it's hard to put a number on it. It's amazing the breakthroughs that are happening all the time. And one of the things, well, I guess I should give this a little context. Within the second shift, one of the first things that happens is the President of the United States comes out and announces to the public in a press conference that not only has the U.S. government had a secret program to try to reverse engineer the technologies of a damaged alien craft they've had for decades, but that they've made breakthroughs that are so startling that he can no longer justify, you know, keeping that a secret from the public. So there's this project called the ROE Project, and it's spelled RHO, and it's run out of Los Alamos, and they're going to begin rolling out some of the, quote, beneficial technologies to the public over the coming months. So that kind of gets the story spun up and going. you know, one of the things that happens early on, and I guess, you know, well, a lot of people ask me about this, is we meet our three protagonists, our three main good guys in the story, and these turn out to be three juniors in high school, and their dads actually work at the labs. And a lot of people have asked me, well, why in a pretty violent and an adult story did you pick, you know, three high school juniors as the guys to go up against these major forces? And really, there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one is, guess what? That's the same age of young person that every military in the world likes to use as their frontline soldiers. You know, when you think back about you know, those teen years, at that age, young teens left to themselves will try almost anything to prove, you know, who they are, what they are, what they're capable of, and they don't really have a good sense of their own mortality at that particular point.
Yeah,
so they'll try stuff that is outrageous, and so that was one reason I wanted to pick that type of young person. That's the same basic age group that we have fighting for us overseas right now, in large measure, and the other reason for that is within the context of the novel. You know, this, I mentioned, it's kind of a story on multiple levels, and one is, of course, this questioning about what the government is telling you. Well, these young people come from a background where they have a very almost overly comfortable lifestyle. I mean, their small little world is a comfortable, good place at the start of the series. And well, within the context of the series, that comfortable world gets ripped apart based on the circumstances that they find themselves thrown into. And one of the first things that causes this to occur is because they stumble upon a second alien ship, thus the name of the book, The Second Ship. Anyway, they're in the Los Alamos area out doing rock climbing and stuff like this before their junior year opens up, and they stumble into this cavern, and it turns out that back in the 40s, what the government found in this crashed alien ship that they've got their hands on was actually one of two ships that arrived, and when those ships got here, they were fighting. They were locked in combat, and they ended up shooting each other down. Well,
yeah.
The second one was never found until current day. Well, these young people, when they find it, they know, you know, that they should turn this thing over, that this is a big find. But they also know that, you know, if they do that, they'll never get a chance to examine it or to look inside it. The government will lock it away, and it'll be classified, and they'll, you know, they will have lost their chance. So being the people they are, and probably like something we would probably do, they decide, well, we're at least going to take a look inside this thing. Well, when they do that, One of the things that happens that changes their lives is they end up activating a system. They try on these kind of headset-looking things, and that ends up activating a link that connects them up mentally, their mind and the computer on board the ship. Now, without giving anything away, that really brings me up to a topic I wanted to talk about, which is, it kind of runs through the series of novels. And this is one of those technologies which a lot of people consider pretty laughable, this idea that you could make a direct mental link with a computer system and it with you. But, without getting into any programs that are approaching what is being worked on at a classified level, this is one of the technologies that we are incredibly close on. In fact, I'm sure you've seen stories recently where people that are blind have been able to have electrodes implanted in their brain that allow them to see what a camera, to have imagery transmitted into their brain. And there's been lots of stories recently about a general topic which I think everybody needs to be aware of and concerned about. Not that it's bad, but that, every startling breakthrough, has amazing potential for both good and bad. And this one is related to pattern recognition capabilities of current computers, such as voice recognition and face recognition. Now, a big topic of research for some time has been this whole concept of pattern recognition on brainwaves that are, you can think about what they feed into an electroencephalogram.
Right.
Brain patterns are being studied very intently, and computers are learning to recognize what people are thinking about. And this can be very useful for, people that are paralyzed and need to control the computer screen. They can't do keyboard input, but they can think things, and the computer can pick it up. But it also has a lot of potential for dangerous applications, and I say dangerous in the civil liberties sense of the word. if you think of the old technology of lie detectors, for example, the system is essentially measuring changes in vital signs and conductivity of the skin and stuff like that. That is about to become completely passé. And the potential is out there in the very near future for things like understanding what you're thinking about without you giving your consent to participate in some kind of a let's say an experimental program or something like this. And those are things that I just think people need to be aware of the potential consequences of some of the things that are coming.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with technology is that it tends to advance at a rate that's far beyond what human beings can appreciate. The whole, just the notion just of Moore's Law, technology, doubling in just the number of transistors in a CPU doubling every 18 months.
Well, what's really funny about that too, and I'm sure with your computer background, you're well aware of it, is most scientists in the late 80s and 90s thought that Moore's Law would kind of peter out probably toward in the next 10 years or so, just because.
Yeah.
You can't keep going at that kind of a rate. But in fact, the opposite has happened. Moore's Law is operating big time, and in fact, things seem to be accelerating and maybe even in a more aggressive way than he imagined.
Yeah, I mean, given the fact that, Moore's Law was supposed to peter out where you hit certain fundamental limits in terms of how far you could design down to before you hit, quantum problems with the way the circuits would work. But those things are being overcome. So
right. Well, the funny thing about it,
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the funny thing about what you just said is that's exactly right. You know, the to try to put it in a little simpler terms, you know, there's problems when things get very small. With electricity, you know, it's not really these little hard particles called electrons. They tend to smear out and have they occupy more than one place at a time. And down at the as you get circuitry so small, as you were mentioning, these electrons can actually be on two wires at a time or on the wrong wire at a time. So physicists were predicting that when we hit a certain limiting size, that you just couldn't get any more or get any faster. But in effect, what's happening is they're figuring out tricks that you can do at a quantum level that actually give you better performance because of these uncertainties that have to do with physical boundaries. So anyway, it's just a wild world out there as far as advancements go.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're talking about is the quantum tunneling, where it just, you know, the particles just cause all these unintended effects. But, you know, in my mind, I was looking at it and I'm saying, well, you know, when I first heard about the limit, you know, and this was some years back, and I thought, well, that's baloney. They're going to figure this out. And, you know, in my mind, the way you look at nature, when nature is doing these things to you, you know, listen to the lesson and then apply it and take advantage of those. And I think that's kind of where they're going with it. They've learned to exploit that. And,
right. They just don't know ahead of time. A lot of times they can see problems that are coming, but by the time you get there, solutions will have been, technology will have advanced and solutions you never thought of will be in place to handle a lot of these problems.
Yeah, I mean, some people would be surprised to know that the rate of human knowledge, last time I checked this statistic, and I'm not sure if it's even gone faster than what I'm going to say, but the rate of human knowledge acquisition is doubling every 5 years based on our current technological evolution. So we're just getting literally smarter and smarter, if you will. There's just more resources to be able to throw at problems, and our expertise is getting better and better. But at the same time, you know, human beings have a certain bandwidth, and we can only appreciate this in very limited slices.
Well, and so, one other thing that hasn't gone quite as anticipated, and by the way, I just wanted to throw out a little bit of information. If we bypass something and folks out there want to find out a little more information about the Row Agenda series and the Second Ship, you can go on my website at secondship.com, and I've got excerpts and reviews and things like that up there. Plus, I post links to past interview shows. This one will be up there tomorrow, et cetera. So,
okay.
But one of the things that didn't go quite as expected was artificial intelligence research. And for a long time, I think people, computer scientists thought that this would be solved by trying to understand how the human brain works and mapping that onto a computer. But it turns out that technique doesn't work very well. First of all, they don't understand very well how the human brain works. And secondarily, the computer works and has certain advantages and certain disadvantages compared to the human brain. So this has led to something that is, is pretty heavily discussed in the Row Agenda series. But essentially, it boils down to a concept of pattern recognition, and the way computers recognize patterns is pretty alien in a lot of cases to the way humans think about things. And what I'm talking about essentially is areas such as neural network technology and genetic programming, things like this where the computer kind of comes up with its own way of recognizing things. And the reason this is important is because as computers advance, it's not certain we're going to recognize the point at which they become, let's say, in quotes, they acquire artificial intelligence. The fact is, right now, computers are able to learn, and they are starting to learn better and better. And an easy example is, I've got on my desk right here a laptop by a company recently bought by Dell called Alienware.
Yeah.
Not for the name, but because they're darn good computers. But this laptop, you sit down in front of it, and the camera on the screen logs you in by recognizing your face. And it has to, you know, the first time it does it, it's not that good at it. But each time you sit down there, it gets better and better at it. And that's a simplistic, let's say an oversimplification of some of the technologies that are being worked on out there. But the way these things do it is not like you and I would recognize a face. It's very, very different. And so the point I'm trying to make is we don't know, and I think computer scientists have really accepted this right now, is that because computers are becoming so much more powerful, we don't really know for sure what it's going to be that causes the big AI breakthrough, but it's probably going to be something that the computer evolves on its own within the programming that's running on the system itself.
Whoa, you mean it's just spontaneous, I think I've heard this called emergent behavior.
Well, where, I mean, I would agree with that characterization. And spontaneous, the reason you had me hemming and hawing a little bit there is, you know, computers are programmed, and, you know, and it still takes people to program them. But a lot of the programs, especially some of the massively parallel stuff, is relying on this kind of brute force learning that the computer can do. And if you think about a few years ago now, when IBM's computer Deep Blue first started beating world champions in chess, it was essentially doing it just with brute force. You know, analyzing so many things that that essentially was looking at all possible outcomes. Now, in the real world, all possible outcomes aren't possible. But what is capable of happening is allowing a computer through this learning process and through this waiting process on various nodes to, in a way, add to its own programming. It's analyzing. It's got systems that are watching its own systems, and they're essentially giving it grades. They're giving the program that's running grades, saying this is working well. This worked faster. I'm going to remember this. This was a faster way of doing this. And in a way, it's taking pieces of programs that are out there written by humans, and employing them in a way that wasn't originally designed into the system.
Yeah.
So these type of things may result in great and wonderful things, but they have to be really be thought through closely, because a lot of times unintended consequences can really surprise you.
Skynet.
Well, yeah, hopefully not.
Well, that, you know, it's funny. I remember a very simplistic computer model. You know, I saw this some years back, and it was a model showing birds flying around in a virtual world, and some very simple rules were programmed into this model. And basically, what happened was these birds were to fly towards an obstacle, and they would choose to fly, you know, either left or right around it. So it was basically a pole sticking up. And what happened was they had not programmed in what would happen when you had flocks of these things. And one of the behaviors that emerged was these birds tended to flock together, which was not intended. And the other thing is when they would fly as a flock towards one of these obstacles, they would literally, and it just looked like something you would see out of nature. They would just, you know, split apart, go around it, and then merge back together, and they would move almost exactly like what you would see in a natural setting. And so to me, it just seems natural that these are the kinds of things we're going to see happen with this kind of technology. It's just inevitable.
Well, it is, and in a way, it's really exciting. And it certainly is. You know, there's the old story out of Los Alamos, which most everybody knows that Los Alamos was created by the government as a part of the Manhattan Project to design the atomic bomb back in the 40s. And it was created in this out-of-the-way spot, which is a really neat place for the all those folks that haven't been out there. You drive out of Santa Fe headed north towards Taos, New Mexico, and it's kind of this high canyon country. And you turn off to the west onto the highway going up to Los Alamos, and you rise through this really steep, rugged canyon country, and you come into town there. It's up on this mesa about 8,000 feet up. And they still have some of the Cold War guard towers up and everything, so it's easy to get the impression as you come into Los Alamos that maybe you're coming into some spot you don't belong in. But it's a beautiful place, and you know some of the things that are being worked on up there. You have to use a little bit of imagination based on what's being done out in the open at a lot of these other. Other scientific programs, because when you talk about, for example, parallel computing and this, you know, the behavior you talked about, which is these birds in a simple program kind of learning seemingly outside the realm of what was thought about by the programmer to behave in a flock or a swarm manner is something called swarm computing. And in swarm computing, and again, this comes into play in the second ship and in the Real Agenda series, is where relatively simple programs or simple machines, when they get together and they perform as a group, their behavior changes, and that behavior takes on something that. That a number of scientists have likened to the behavior of bees that seems very intelligent. Okay, bees are doing this complicated thing as a group, but an individual bee, you know, doesn't have that much brain power associated with it.
Yeah.
So these group behaviors by simple programs and simple little machines are things that are contemplated in areas such as nanotechnology and also in these massively parallel computing systems where the individual processors, the individual microprocessors, are not that powerful, but you start putting together thousands and millions of these things, and each is working on its own little part of a bigger problem that's been chopped up into tiny little pieces. And these things can really do surprising and sometimes very unexpected things.
Yeah, it's funny because I've been studying just over the last 10 years, just keeping an eye on nanotech. And one of the areas that, you know, I mean, I'm in the propulsion business. You know, I work out at Aerojet, and, you know, we've been doing this for, you know, for a long time, working with actually some kinds, different kinds of nanomaterials that help us with, you know, our propellants and things like that. In different ways, and I won't go into all of that, but the bottom line is that, you know, nanotech is here now. I don't know how far it is in the labs, but it's going to become part of everyday life. And one of the areas that, you know, we have a specific interest in is, for example, it's, you know, if you took a, say, now we have defunct technologies like the Titan rocket, that's all been moved out. But one of the models I saw talked about in one book was talking about taking a Titan engine, which we manufactured for 50 years, and making that 10 times lighter and 100 times you know, more useful and more efficient and lightweight enough that two men could pick up the entire motor, you know, or engine by itself. So these are the kinds of things that, you know, just from a dumb perspective, if you will, they are able to produce these materials. But the other thing is that nanotechnology can be active, meaning, let's say you have an engine in flight, it would have the ability to sense certain conditions that need to change and act accordingly on its own, almost like an organism.
Well, and that's really neat stuff because, a lot of times people think of nanomachines and they think of something that is really difficult. Now, when you think of a machine like we think of a macro machine like a car, okay, they've done microscopic work on things like that, making little propeller-driven molecular-type machines. But I think the more interesting stuff actually is on the what you call the dumber side. And this is where, it's been the subject of a number of popular movies, for example, where the types of materials you're talking about, all you've got to think about is that you think about a little LCD screen, okay? In a way, this is the type of behavior we're talking about. You apply a little current to a particular type of microscopic material, and it changes the nature or the way that material interacts with its neighbors.
Yeah.
And some of those interactions, although on a molecule-by-molecule basis aren't that strong, when they all cooperate, when all those material elements cooperate in the right way, you get potentially huge effects out of that.
Yeah, I coined the term active materials just based on the studies I have had, and I'm no expert in this, but I've kept track of it. It just seems to me, I mean, the effects in just about every area of society are, boundless, just the medical technology alone. I mean, I've got a father right now who's had a stroke 2 years ago, and just think of the possibilities for injecting these, devices into the brain and actually doing repair work.
Right, and
the human body in ways we can't imagine,
Right, and these devices don't have to, one of the problems, that keeps coming up is when you hear what I'll say the scientific naysayers talking about technologies that are beyond our reach at the moment, is going back to the discussion we had earlier with Moore's Law. They envision a problem, okay, and they don't see a current solution to that problem. So they project mentally a straight line image that says we cannot get there because this problem is going to stop us before the final objective. But they make no account for unexpected advances as you're moving your way toward that problem, okay? One of these things in nanotechnology that is regarded as a major problem and nano really refers to this concept of a nanometer or 10 to the minus ninth meters, whereas typically now we think of small things as on the micron level or 1 millionth of a meter. But this concept that a complicated machine can be done at that small of a scale is regarded as a problem. But what they fail to realize is you don't have to have the complicated machine. Within the context of what we've just been talking about, you can have a swarm of simple machines or simple, doesn't even have to be necessarily a machine. If you could, for example, engineer a cell to behave in a certain way, let's say a blood cell or some bodily cell, and it has the capability of influencing the behavior of adjacent cells, essentially you've come up with the same thing. You've come up with a machine that's made up of tiny parts of cooperating material.
Yeah, and that's the part I look at, just the medical aspects are, if it can get to that point with just a small machine like that, you can imagine injecting these into the body and overcoming diseases and rendering this whole healthcare debate a moot point. And imagine the other things that happen. Everything that we could think of could be affected. Transportation changing completely around, getting off oil. I mean, the ability to construct buildings and highways, things like that, with a lot less effort. So I know I'm talking in utopian terms here, but you know, you start to see the effect of these changes, and they're just huge, and they all come from something so tiny.
Absolutely, and of course, you know, like we said earlier, every potential good change also has the potential to be abused or to have some unintended consequences. But I think, you know, science in general is about that. It's about, back in the 40s, this is not a good example, but you know, while they were working on the atomic bomb out at Los Alamos, there were a number of scientists that were worried about potentially setting the atmosphere of the planet on fire when they did the first test. Because of the high temperatures they would achieve, but you know, the scientists doing the program, they looked at that and they said, well, the probability is pretty darn small. You know, this program is pretty important, so they decided to go ahead with the program. You know, luckily they were right. Of course, we wouldn't have had to worry about it if they were wrong. but there are things associated with every one of these major new breakthrough type programs that have extremely dangerous consequences if it's not handled, if it's not well thought through, and really a lot of safeguards put into it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the areas in nanotech I've seen discussed has been the whole idea that not putting limits on self-reproduction of these machines, where they basically take off and go off in a direction that we had not intended them to, and potentially wreaking havoc. So the idea that you have, I guess, like Isaac Asimov's, rules of robotics, but applied to, controls for on what, how far these things can propagate before they get out into the world. And then the other option, things are, what happens when they start evolving on their own and, kind of get out of our control? Do they supersede us?
It's been a big concern for some time in the genetic engineering field. But really, when you think about it, we've been genetically engineering plants from the beginning. Anytime you splice one plant into another plant to make a hybrid, which has been done forever, essentially that was a form of genetic engineering. Now, one of the big concerns now is, of course, that you modify genes that then get passed on to the next generation, and you've essentially changed that particular breed of humans from then on. Getting back to what you were talking about on the nanotech side, there you're not necessarily, although you could be talking about genetic engineering, but if the little machines that get injected into you become self-sustaining, then there might be a point when you'd like to get rid of these things, and it might not be an easy thing to do.
Yeah, that one of the books I'd read about the subject, I believe it's Ray Kurzweil, Age of Spiritual Machines, and I think he did another subsequent novel, and I'm still working my way through it, and I can't remember the title right off, but he was talking about, programmed death for these things. So they would go in and combat cancer, or they would combat injury like a spinal cord injury, go in and do the repairs they need to, and then they could be inactivated just by a simple radio signal or a coded signal. And it would just be something you could buy over the counter, even for if you have a cold, you swallow some of these and boom, they target the virus and it's done. That's just, one aspect of it. But, from what I gather, you're saying is this stuff is really quite far along then, or on the cusp, though. We're about to see this in the next 5 to 10 years are going to be these.
Well, you'll certainly see parts of, now not every technology I talk about in the second chip is that close. I think some of the some of the research is farther along than people think, by quite a good bit. And you know, I've always had to be a little careful talking about which is what. But I think people can use their own heads. I mean, things are out there in the publicly available research, and you know, with somebody like my background writing a novel about what I've written about, and someone that's if they're just wanting to be entertained, it's an entertaining sci-fi series. But if they're wanting to do a little more deep thought and take a look at the technologies that are being talked about and what's available out in the public, and then just spend a little bit of time thinking about the amount of money spent in these secret research programs, you can form a pretty good approximation of where we're at.
Yeah, one of the things that was a dominant theme in the book that, and I'm still not finished, I purposely did not finish it so I could not know the ending and not divulge it. So I'm 80 pages away, but I've been just really enjoying it. But the device, you know, of them connecting up through the headbands to the ship was something that I noticed in a book by Colonel Philip J. Corso had talked about in basically discussion of what was actually captured and analyzed back in the early 60s when he had the technology and the reports at his desk at the Pentagon. And, you know, basically it was he wrote a report that analyzed these things and talked about how, you know, these alien creatures were controlling the ship with their minds and how the whole, you know, he had a whole theory of how it all worked. And it's you see that throughout the book, but the difference here is that human beings could actually tap into it, is, you know, and I really thought that was interesting how the ship adapted to people, and the pain that they went through, where they kind of learned each other, you know, and you could see that the ship was developing a relationship, which I was most unexpected. I never thought about it in those terms, you know.
Well, so, you know, there's a little backstory. You know, obviously, in this particular case, happens to be one of the technologies that is talked about heavily out in the public right now in a lot of categories. Certainly not at the level that I discussed it in the second ship. But this concept that goes back to pattern recognition. Okay, when you get advanced computing systems and they are looking for relationships, I mean, and not in the way you just mentioned it, but in the way of learning to recognize something, okay? And a computer thinks about things very differently, and you could certainly be convinced that a more advanced technologies computing systems would have solved many of the issues that we currently have with this. But this notion of analyzing your brain pattern and also being able to inject imagery and sounds back into your mind, both of which we are able to do in various public demonstrations right now, that allows you, with some advanced pattern recognition thrown in, to very quickly understand what thoughts mean, even if you're not familiar with the language. You know, just by recording and comparing the thought versus you know, the action associated with that. So this is something that is very, very important in research right now, and I think is going to play a major role in a short amount of time.
Do you think that some of the first adoption of that, I'm sure it will be, you know, remember the movie, I think it's Firefox?
Yeah, the old Clint Eastwood movie?
Yeah, I mean, the notion of being able to fire missiles just by thinking about it and, you know, and control aspects of an in-flight aircraft, or actually, you know, to control maybe even a missile's flight just by looking at the target. Now, I've heard some rumblings about that recently, and I can't remember where, but where targeting just by looking at a particular item. A computer was looking at the eyeball, for example, and being able to, you know, see what's happening, see where a guy's looking, and then all the weapons is, basically get to the general direction, and then they take it from there.
Yeah, I'm so not well. Without getting into weapons programs, well, one thing I can tell you about that is something I was looking at just the other day is they've now been able to do at a university setting. I can't remember which one right off the top of my head, but essentially by hooking up electrodes to the subject's head so that they can measure and process brain activity patterns, been able to rapidly identify among a group of a number of different people. In fact, I think there's a video of it actually out there on YouTube where the computer quickly learns to recognize whether the subject wants a little, you can think of it as a light, a ping pong ball of light to move left or right, up or down, et cetera, on the computer screen. And without looking at their eyes or anything like that, they just think about the ball, the little virtual ball moving in a certain direction, and the computer quickly learns to adapt to those thoughts. So that is exactly the same thing at a much lesser scale, but exactly the same thing as turning an aircraft left or right or up or down. And so you can just use your own imagination on military applications of this type of thing.
It's funny. I saw a story on one of the popular science websites talking about an F-22 Raptor model that had been integrated with a neural net system that really very advanced design, but it kind of a simplistic application. They basically threw the thing out there and said, go learn how to fly an F-22 by crashing a lot. And this thing, it started off and it went through, you know, a whole series of learning sessions where they basically just kept at it, and it was getting discouraging, and all of a sudden it just picked it up, and it was that fast. And I actually saw the playback of some of these abilities this thing had picked up, and it was they were throwing weather at it. And it was navigating to a particular heading it was supposed to go to with no apparent problems. It was doing exactly what a pilot would do and being able to handle everything thrown at it. So I was just stunned. It was just, you know, you could see this.
And that's what I was talking about as far as being the alien nature of learning on computer systems that are these heavily parallel systems. And a neural net is essentially that. And in this case, I'm sure they were doing this on a simulator, but simulators, the flying a simulator, you can fly a simulator, you can fly the real thing. And the way a lot of these neural nets learn is just exactly like you said. They try everything. In this case, crashing is considered bad. So when the bad event happens,
gone.
Yeah, when the bad event happens, the other you can think of it as layered neural nets. One is judging the performance of the other one and remembering, okay, that was a bad event, so that's bad, so don't do it that way again. And they do it again, and bad, 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 and pretty soon something good happens, and then it's okay, that pattern was a good pattern. And these behaviors all of a sudden start acquiring more and more good, i.e. non-bad events, and pretty soon the thing is behaving in a way that is only good.
Yeah, self-amplifying behavior based on the feedback. It's all about the feedback, you know, and once they acquire enough of these learning sessions, it's just remarkably quick. I've been kind of toying with the idea of getting into it and playing around with it. I'm an old procedural programmer, and just now getting into object-oriented coding and that kind of thing in the business I'm in, and been playing with some of that and just going, whoa, some of these neural net kits you can buy just for your own just to explore that, you know, that whole world are just amazing. So imagine some kids that get hold of this, they're going to, You know, I'm really trying hard to talk our guys into saying, hey, hire some new kids. Come on, bring them in. We'll give them all the toys they want, and then we'll just help them, you know, navigate the rough spots and do something really cool with this stuff. So, but you grew up in this whole realm of small town America, and around all this military world around you. How did you decide to go this way? I mean, just on a personal note.
Well, it was really kind of funny. I when I was in high school, and I didn't come from a military family or anything like that. But when I was in high school, I was always fascinated with science fiction, et cetera. But the reason I got interested in the military academy is I went to Boys State in New Mexico, which is it's kind of like a summer camp for the students that are doing well in school. So I'd gone to that, and at Boys State that particular year, and in fact every year, the military academies had a team of cadets that would come out and make presentations about, you know, their school, and some other schools did too. Getting you thinking about college and what that's like. And the academy presentation was very attractive to me. You know, most university presentations involved, these are our classrooms, we've got nice scientific facilities, good sports facilities, things like that. But the academies, you know, they had things like the Air Force Academy, you can fly a jet, you know. In the case of West Point, they had guys jumping out of airplanes, rappelling down sides of cliffs, doing all this stuff. So it was actually the adventurous side of things that that hooked my attention, and then I applied. I got nominated by a state senator, and my application ended up being accepted, and so I went, and I knew it was going to be tough. I was a little bit surprised at how shocking the initial integration was, but that's how I got started in that whole thing.
Well, and when you basically this whole subject of UFOs, I mean, you come from a background real similar to mine, and I grew up around, you know, that area, and you know the talk. I mean, a lot of folks, you know, whisper about this stuff, and the stuff that does get out to the public about it, you know, Corso and this kind of stuff is out there in droves. I, for one, am pretty convinced that Roswell happened. And, you know, I'm looking at what you wrote, and a lot of it is, you know, uses that as kind of a backdrop. What are your feelings about Roswell, you know, as a prototype case? And what are your thoughts about aliens and the potential that they are visiting our planet?
Well, you know, having been born in Roswell and grown up around that area, you know, I had met, even though it happened a good bit before my time, you know, as I was born in 56 and the actual Roswell incident happened in 47. But I had met a bunch of the people that either had been touched by the incident or had worked closely with people that were involved. And the underlying theme of all of that as I was growing up that I gathered out of it was, you know, these were people that were just very common, down-to-earth people, didn't know anything about alien spacecraft or anything like this, but they believed that what they had seen was real and that it wasn't any parachute dummies and it wasn't any tinfoil from a balloon. And there started to be a strong feeling in the area in general among the local folks that they were just not being told anything, not only truthful, but they were they were being told things that were flat out ridiculous as far as explanations go, and plus the explanations kept changing. So I guess out of that, the biggest thing I took, having not been a part of the original situation, was to maintain a questioning mind, that just because someone in authority tells you something doesn't necessarily mean that you have to take it at face value.
Yeah,
as far as intelligent life on other planets goes, I think it's absolutely ridiculous to assume that we are the only intelligent life or anywhere close to the most advanced species that's out there. I mean, the odds, even just thinking about it from a pure probability perspective, doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to me, at least. So
yeah,
I certainly believe there's alien life out there and intelligent alien life.
Yeah, and I would tend to think that, you brought it home really powerfully, the whole notion that there are folks out there at NASA, people I've actually talked with, who insist that we will never overcome the distance barrier. And I look at them and I go, sure, no. you've even got your own website out there that shows the advanced propulsion technologies that are coming about, and that warp drive essentially is a doable thing. It's just, here we have a 13.7 billion year old universe, billions of galaxies, and somebody hasn't figured this out yet. I tend to think not.
For one thing, I mean, it all goes back to this topic, and it's one of the underlying themes in the second ship, is that you can limit yourself by your assumptions, and that's one of the things that our science does that I really don't like, is because we've got a set of assumptions that our model is built on, and let's take one that is challenged directly in the second ship, and that is conservation of energy. Okay, conservation of energy is a key underlying aspect of all of our physics models. And that essentially says that, energy can be changed back and forth in form, but the quantity remains the same. It can change into matter. Matter can change back into energy.
Right.
But overall, it's conserved in our universe. But there's an easy test that is, a concept that is thrown out there in the second ship that could potentially cause you to say that, wait, energy is not conserved in our universe, and in fact there's leakage back and forth between our space and something called subspace. And that is this whole notion of the redshift, okay? And the redshift is this... this fact that we've observed that all the stars out there and galaxies, et cetera, the farther away they are from us, the more the light from them seems to have shifted into the red spectrum. And the thinking behind that in our current theory is that, well, that's because when they were thrown out from the Big Bang, of course, the ones that move the fastest got the farthest away by now, so they're going the fastest away from us. So their Doppler shifted into the red more.
Yeah.
But by simply changing an assumption, if you say, okay, let's say that's not generally the case, but let's imagine that there's a tiny bit of leakage into subspace for every step that a light wave takes. So it would take, it's a tiny, tiny effect, but the farther you go, the greater that leakage is. Well, if you're losing energy over distance, guess what that does? That causes a redshift. And in that scenario, it's an explanation that that does not fit the current norm, but also is an indicator of a space that lies between the granularity of our space, at something called the Planck length. There's a very tiny, tiny... measurement that amounts to the particles, the distance between the particles in our space-time. And between that, you have to ask yourself the question, what lies between that? What lies between the graininess of our space-time? And in the second ship, that's, of course, a subspace material that has a much different and much faster speed of waves through it. So if you can shift yourself into subspace, the idea is you're not limited by our speed of light anymore, and you're able to move much, much faster without violating any sort of light limitation.
Whoa. I've heard, you know, and that's a different take on it. I've never heard that before. Now, I just had gotten to the point where you were talking about that in the book, so now I know something there. You know, the question is that actual physics, or is that something that's being, you know, pitched right now as a meaning for this redshift?
Well, it is certainly a proposed physics mechanism. Now, it has not been, it has not been proved, but at the same time, what you have to look at is everything is a model. Every one of our physics theories is a model, and you have to ask yourself, is your model enabling you to do what you want to do with it? Okay. Right now, our model places a ton of limitations on what we're willing to think is possible. You can't go faster than the speed of light. There are lots of things like that that our physics model doesn't allow for. So the bottom line is, I think some of the most advanced thinkers are thinking about ways of applying new models that allow us to think about the possibility of doing some of these things that are not allowed under the current physics model. By the way, one of the things about the current model is called the standard model. And the standard model, of course, the proponents of that have one giant hope, and that hope is that in the Large Hadron Collider outside of CERN, which has been shut down for about a year now, but which is scheduled to come back up online later this year, that they are praying and hoping that they can find the Higgs boson, which is the so-called God particle, because this is a particle predicted by the standard model to tie up loose ends, essentially. And if they find that, that'll go a long way towards supporting their current theory. If they don't find it, guess what? Big problems for the current model. So I think Stephen Hawking said the most interesting thing that could happen out of the Large Hadron Collider project is not finding the Higgs boson.
Well, it would be money well spent, even if they don't find what they were looking for. Then it answers a question.
Well, absolutely. In fact, that would be very well spent in my book, because it means start looking around for a different model.
Of course, they had that accidental.
Well,
they actually burned up part of the darn machine when they turned it on and were running up their tests. And I looked at that.
Well, yeah, actually, it's a funny thing, because in the third book of the series, which I call Wormhole, is actually a large part of that is set at in Geneva at this test point on the Large Hadron Collider, which where there's a big experiment called the Atlas experiment set up.
Oh, okay. And what happens with that? If we can...
well, you know, I won't give away the whole thing, but let's just say that it questions the public story about why the Large Hadron Collider was shut down last year. You know, the Large Hadron Collider, there's been a number of people that have speculated that the energies achieved in some of these super collisions, you know, could be large enough to create a microscopic black hole or some other strange event. And, of course, that would not be great for the planet. Now, most physicists believe that the likelihood of that are not high, and if it did happen, you know, it would only remain for a tiny, tiny fraction of a second before it dissolved. There are, you know, in any big technological adventure, there are always these type of risks to be looked at. So I take a look at them.
What I remember from the headlines was that there were actually government actions being looked at from a court. In the courts, people were really proceeding from fear, and all of the best evidence was that if it did create a black hole, it was just going to evaporate within a very short time, and would not just expand and just consume the planet, and it wouldn't have been a very
long. There are a lot of theories out there. One of them recently, and one of the funny things is in the prelude chapter to The Second Ship, I talk about something I did some research on at Los Alamos, which is called Cherenkov radiation. but Cherenkov radiation, there's a ton of new telescopes around the world that make use of Cherenkov radiation to detect both neutrinos and also to detect high-energy cosmic radiation. And the reason this is interesting in this current context is they've made some recent measurements that that have them scratching their heads a little bit, and essentially it boils down to high energy photons taking longer to get to the Earth than low energy photons from some of these big cosmic events. So that causes some real concern with some of the standard theories, which is the speed of light is the speed of light. And if the speed of light isn't the same for energetic photons as for the lesser energetic photons, this causes some problems in current theory.
Yeah, because you're making the assumption that it's 186,000 miles per second that's absolute for any of these particles. Or photons. I mean, they're not a particle. Well, wave-particle duality. Okay.
Right, and the other implication is if that's not correct, then space is different than what they think. It's filled with a frothy type of stuff that certain aspects of string theory have predicted, but it's different than they thought it was.
Yeah, I've heard the term quantum foam and M-theory, and I'm just... Oddly enough, I'm writing my own science fiction novel, and I'm dealing with some of those topics in my own research right now. And it's just it's amazingly deep stuff, but the thing you start finding is that, just like you're saying, the standard model for what we think the universe is and the model you were talking about that everybody is pinning their hopes on, well, again, it's just a model, and it's very likely wrong, which it it's just, I think 100 years from now, it's just what you're going to say it was going to be. It's going to be comical what our beliefs look like. And, we think we know it all, but we don't.
Well, and I just think we should always start with the assumption that our model is wrong. And we should look forward to finding things that are wrong with our model, especially if those things allow us to do something that our model said we couldn't do.
Well, yeah, that's the part I find that when these institutions, and I've seen it, in my own workplace with some pretty brilliant people, they get that focal point of they're very invested in their particular worldview, and it's just like you said, they have the expertise, and they know this piece of the puzzle really well, but over across the pond someplace, somebody's doing some different research that blows out of the water what they spent 30 years learning to do, and changes the complexion of what they were all about. And to me, science should celebrate that. And unfortunately, you have political realities and people with reputations and egos, and that gets interesting.
Yeah, and it's natural. I mean, people want to defend what they have been lecturing on. And it runs against the grain to admit, hey, I might be dead wrong.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here. My chat room just decided to close on us, so I'm restarting it, and I hope I just didn't lose everybody. So we're putting them all back on. If everybody's still listening and you want to be back in the chat, I restarted it. So Blog Talk, there you are, Brian. I see you. Sorry, guys. Wasn't me doing it. Something just blew up at Blog Talk. They've been having fun tonight. My audio stream was a little weird today, so I hope everything's good. Anyway, Now, let's look at what's happening in your books. I mean, you've got the second book, I think, is just about to come out.
Well, the second book is, what I did is I released it first, and this is probably of interest to all the folks out there that are writing their own books or that have, whether it's nonfiction or fiction. But I released the second ship first and the second book, which is called Immune, on the electronic format supported by the Amazon Kindle.
Yeah.
And that's been very, very successful for me. In fact, the second ship's been in the top 10 in several Amazon Kindle sci-fi categories for several weeks now. And then this summer, I released, I published the second ship in paperback through Synergy Books. And Immune is done. The second one of that, it's been through my editor. It's completely done. But I'm in negotiations right now with a publication, a publisher for the rights to all three novels, and then it's going to package them. They'll be available separately, too. Until that's done, Immune won't be officially released. However, I've released it on the Kindle, and I've also made it available through my website. There's a link to a print-on-demand pre-published. It's still a paperback, but it's print-on-demand paperback. That's available out there. So people can go through secondship.com and get, they can read excerpts from Second Ship and from Immune. And also I've got an excerpt on there from book three, which is called Wormhole.
Oh, yeah, and I saw those out there, and I was going to go pull those down to a copy of the other one real soon. So I'm coming to the end of this. I'm glad I'm going to get the second book real soon.
I'll shoot you a signed copy of that, John. So,
okay.
So you'll get a copy of Immune.
Now, you mentioned the Kindle. Just curious, here I am. I'm writing nonfiction right now and a fiction setup. So I'm kind of doing a lot at one time, and I'm working my way through it. But you think the Kindle program is pretty good?
It's not going to give you the mass audience that you eventually you got to go paperback or through regular publication. But ebooks are taking off a lot, and the nice thing for authors of the Amazon Kindle is it costs you nothing to publish. You go on through the Amazon process, set up an account, you configure your bank account information on there, and then you publish to the Kindle format, which is a proprietary format. I mean, not anybody can just print out your stuff, and they have to actually purchase it.
Right.
But Amazon, it shows up on Amazon. It's downloadable in Kindle format. You can set the pricing on it, and the money, as people start buying it and start, of course, you still have to work to build up the buzz for your work, but it starts to show up in various bestseller lists on Amazon, and that in a way is very self-promotional. So it's a very good mechanism, and I found it very simple, and best of all, it doesn't cost you any money, and it's quick. The paperback publication process is so slow that sometimes it's fairly frustrating.
Yeah, I was not looking forward to dealing with the Seven Sisters and going to try to promote my own. And I just I kept looking at Kindle thinking, that looks like the way to do this. And you've just sold me on it. So I think that's where I'm going to go with my baby when it's done here towards the end of the year.
Well, you can't go wrong with that as a part of your strategy. I mean, like I said, it's a good tool, and it's free, and it's quick, and you get, good support on that.
Okay, well, hey, I just wanted to mention, too, that you're going to be appearing on Coast to Coast AM across the whole country right after this. I think you're going to be dialing into them and talking with the hosts there. So, for folks that want to listen in some more to another host talking in with you about all of this, I think I've just had a fabulous time with you, and we'd love to have you back again.
Well, we'll have to do that when I once I've gotten Immune out officially in paperback and Wormhole, definitely love to come back. Oh, by the way, yeah, I'll be on in Coast to Coast at starting 11 p.m. Pacific time, and I'm going to be on there for 3 hours tonight. So it's going to be a long night, but should be a lot of fun.
Okay, well, I'm going to definitely listen in. I might pop in and call in as things go on, so I might say hi to you again. But I definitely want to thank you very much. This has been just a fascinating show. And, you know, you come from the same background I do, so it felt like talking to a relative or a close friend in the business. And definitely, we'll definitely have you back. So thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun. Oh, by the way, I wanted to put in a plug. If anybody wants to see my daughter in her her little cameo role on True Blood, episode 10 of this season, she popped in for a short appearance there, and so that was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, what date's that going to be on, and what?
Well, it was on last week's show, but you can still see that it's showing around, and it's episode 10, and she played this college girl that pops into Lafayette's house looking for V. So she's on for a short time, she's doing great out in L.A., and so wanted to give her a plug.
All right. Well, I think that probably Hulu.com would be a good place to go then. Okay. Well, we're going to go ahead and start winding things down. And thank you, Richard, so much. We're going to definitely look forward to having you back to talk about Immune. So I'll put a tickler out for about 3 months out and see what's going on with you.
Well, that sounds great.
Okay. Well, God bless and thanks a lot. And we will start to... taking the mighty GRI show down, we did plowed right through, which was just not our normal format. Usually I have all the breaks and everything, but I had a blast on this show tonight. So anyway, we're going to go ahead and do a couple of public service things and then wind it down. What we did have was, we've got about 4 minutes left, the Hornet event that I've been helping our good buddy Bob Jennings and his wife Summer. I have not heard anything back as far as any changes, so I think I see you out there in the chat room, Bob. So I think that we're still good and things are still going great. So if you want to get hold of Bob, I'm going to go ahead and pull the email up. OdysseyStarEvents@yahoo.com to deal with any questions about the Hornet and the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum events. So I think we're in good shape. And that is all set. I think we're going to end up doing two shows midweek just to kind of help these guys out and keep the energy rolling for that, to keep that going. So just look for that. I think it's September 1st and September 3rd. The next show we have coming up after that, our normal Friday show, is going to have Spencer Hughes from Fox Across America, and I actually hunted with him for ghosts on the USS Hornet, and we're going to talk about that event and some of the other things he wants to do with ghost hunting. So we have a Fox radio announcer who's going to be on to talk about his experiences in life and the paranormal, and so we look very forward to that. And I'm going to just give us some shout-outs into the chat room. We have Audrey June, and we got Brian. Brian, you've been a trooper, man. You've been saving my tail out there. So you are a real resource for the show. Thank you for all the links, and I'm going to go ahead and grab those and save those so we can look at a few things. And if you could send me that, before we lost the chat room, if you could send me the link to the video that you had before I lost it, because I usually grab this stuff and save it off. And you know, Bob, there you go. Bob's got the did you get my email? I haven't I had the whole show plan thing going on, so I'll take a look at it, but I'll definitely put some information out and keep things going. So September 1 we'll do another show, and if you have any changes or statements, let me know and I'll take care of that. So, hey, we're coming up on the final few minutes or final 45 seconds of the show. And so, again, we want to thank our guest, Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship. And I'll just plug his website. Richard, you still on?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, it's, and so it's
secondship.com.
Okay, secondship.com. So keep an eye on that, and go out and take a look at the reviews, too. They were overwhelmingly positive for what you had out there on the Amazon.com site. So he's going to be developing more, and I hope you write another trilogy after that. So that said, we're in the last 10 seconds. We're going to lose the audio stream, and this is Ghostwriter Paranormal Radio signing off. And thank you so much, everyone.